I want to talk this morning about tests. How many of you have had a test at one point or another in your life? Okay, if you haven't, well, I'm surprised. There are, in our lives, formal tests. Often happen as part of school. There's spelling tests, finals, the Canada Fitness Test that used to be something I did. I think they've maybe come back and made an appearance. I've had other fitness tests where people squeeze my fat and tell me how bad I should feel about myself and make me row 1,000 meters. So there are those kinds of tests, but there are also informal kinds of testing. Experiences, crises we hit in our lives, decisions that come upon us that reveal the quality of our character. And sometimes those tests play an important role in determining the trajectory of our lives. So let me give you some examples of these kind of informal tests. You are alone at home with that thing we call the internet. And the web browser will take you wherever you want to go. It's test time. Maybe another kind of test is something like this. Budget cuts at your workplace has meant that your job was cut too. And a year's worth of help from the career counselor and a whole bunch of resumes out there and retraining has produced a grand total of 0 job offers for you. And now your Christian friends are telling you that you should just trust God because he's good. It's test time. Your friends are concerned because that you don't know when to stop. But there they are, a 12-pack of unopened beers in the fridge. It's test time. Maybe your test is something like this. You're part of a small group, which includes a person who is difficult. They know the correct interpretation of every Bible passage ever. They know how God would vote. In fact, they appear to know God's opinion on every given topic out there, and they have no patience with other views that aren't aligned with God. And your group is struggling, and you know that an honest conversation with said person is going to be painful. It probably would be easiest just to make an excuse why you can't be part of the group anymore and quit. What will your test reveal about you? In a sense, it's not just moments or seasons like that. I would say that in a very real sense, life itself is a big test, right? At the end, our lives, the sum total of our decisions and attitudes, our lives will reveal the quality of our person and the degree to which we have submitted to God and his transforming work in our lives. And Scripture's clear that at the end, Jesus himself will mark the test. No one is going to get 100%. In fact, we can't get 100%, which is why we need Jesus. But nonetheless, Scripture is still clear that God will evaluate whether or not we have been faithful to him, to other people. And he will judge whether we have served or whether we were only self-serving. Today we're in John 13 again, at the beginning of Jesus' final sermon, his farewell address, so to speak. We're calling it his master's class. And as Jesus begins this sermon, which we're going to study for the next few months together, it just so happens that it's also test time for all 13 people in the room. Jesus is apparently the only one who realizes what's at stake. He says it's for that very test, which would happen that night that he was born. But the other 12 guys in the room are somewhat less aware that a test is about to happen. Jesus had given them some hints that the moment was coming, that they should be ready, but I'm not sure they had picked up the cues. And now, ready or not, it was test time. And I want to say to you, ready or not, testing is also coming for you. Are you ready? I have 2 objectives this morning as we study John 13. One, I want to look at the anatomy of a failed test by considering Judas Iscariot. Most of you know a little bit about Judas' life, but I believe there will be something about his failure that could enable us to pass our test, to make good decisions, to strengthen our character and bring honor to God. And perhaps by listening to what the Spirit says through Judas' story, we can save ourselves the agony of a botched test. Maybe even a botched life in which we destroy our integrity, where we hurt other people, and maybe even rebel against the living God. And secondly, I want to consider an important litmus test given by Jesus that reveals how much or how little we really know him. So let's dive into the story. John 13, let's begin at verse 21. After he had said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit and testified, "I tell you the truth, one of you is going to betray me." His disciples stared at one another at a loss to know which of them he meant. One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and said, "Ask him which one he means." Leaning back against Jesus, he asked him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is the one to whom I will give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish." Then, dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, son of Simon. As Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. "What you're about to do, do quickly," Jesus told him. But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the feast or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out, and it was night. Obviously, Judas failed the test. You know what happens next in the garden as he betrayed Jesus and handed him over to the authorities. But how did that happen? How did Judas fail the test? Because on the outside, no one had a clue that Judas was going to fail. He did not seem like a bad guy. Externally, everything looked good for Judas. But that's the thing about real life, right? Externals, appearances do not tell the whole story. Real life is not like the comic books or the movies where you can tell that a person is bad because they have shadowy eyebrows and an evil look, or they live in a haunted house or wear a black cape. In real life, there is no background music warning you that your heart is about to go bad. Wouldn't it be great? You know, you're in a tough situation. You're about to make a decision, and all of a sudden, like, music rises, and you're like, "Ooh, I better pay attention. Something bad is about to happen." It appears to all the disciples and to us that Judas was a pretty good guy. But on the inside, something different was going on. He was making little decisions to skim money from the disciples' living expenses. He said his amens at all the right time when Jesus preached, but deep down, he wasn't really sure that he was fully on board with this preacher. And he began to hold something back, meaning that resentment began to grow in his heart. And without warning, it was the day of the test. And Jesus is so conflicted because he knows what's going to happen, he can't keep it to himself anymore. "One of you is going to betray me," he says. Peter, always the curious guy, motions to John, "Ask him who it is." So John leans back because he's sitting right next to Jesus and says, "Okay, Jesus, who's the guy?" And in a voice that only John can hear, Jesus says, "It's the one to whom I pass this piece of bread." And he takes a piece, he dips it in a little mixture on the table, and he passes it to Judas. This is not just Jesus passing Judas some food. For the host at that time of the meal to dip and pass a morsel of bread like this was a way to honor someone around the table. It's almost as if Jesus was saying, "Look, I know your heart, Judas. I know, although that everything looks normal to these guys here, you've been heading in the opposite direction for a long time. You are about to betray me, but even now, I'd like to honor you. I just washed your feet, Judas, and we can still turn this around. You don't have to go here. It's test time, but even now, I'm offering you a way out." Jesus knew Judas' intentions at that moment, and yet he was still putting out his hand to him. And Judas could have grabbed on. He could have admitted the truth. He could have received forgiveness that we know would have been offered there. Or he could courageously press on his outward trajectory. It was test time. And we know what he chose. As soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. And at that point, he became part of something much bigger, much darker than he could have ever imagined. There was now no turning back. From now on, this wasn't just Judas. He was a pawn of the devil himself. Game over, point, set, match. All right then, Judas, Jesus says, let's get this over with. Whatever you're going to go do it fast. Judas took the bread, went outside, and then John says this. It was night. He doesn't say that because it was after 6 o'clock and the sun had gone down. He mentions the night because the examination is complete. Judas' character has been tested. His true quality is revealed. He has chosen against the light and for darkness. So he heads into the blackness, away from the light, never to return. Which is a real life example of what Jesus taught way back earlier in John chapter 3. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. Putting this all together, we can understand what is happening behind the scenes. For years, Judas had a front row seat, hearing and observing Jesus, the messenger of the light. But despite that privilege, he had not really walked into the light. In fact, he had rejected it. Until that night, it wasn't an overt rejection. It was little decisions, small attitudes here and there, giving in to little temptations, opening the door more and more to evil influences. All that was almost imperceptible except to Jesus. But on the night of the test, all that stuff caught up to him and he was overtaken by darkness. And in a few hours, he would betray the Son of God with a kiss, and he would never live that down. What are the takeaways for us as we face our tests of character? Let me give you three suggestions. Number one, external appearances are not usually a good indicator of what is going on internally. I have this weird habit, every time I read about some heinous crime taking place in Canada, whether that's a murder or some person is arrested as a major drug dealer or they're finally found out, a person they've had a warrant out for a long time, and immediately I look at the interviews that they do with the coworkers of this person or the neighbors of this person. And do you know what those people say almost every time? I'm shocked. I'm surprised. They seemed like such a nice person. I wouldn't have expected that this was going on behind the scenes from the way she interacted with me all the time. Well, what did we expect? That when a person goes bad, their eyes go bloodshot and they grow fangs so that we can tell that they're bad? In fact, Judas' story doesn't shows us that you can't even necessarily tell what's going on in a person's heart by watching what they do. Judas had been at all the events, right there with Jesus at key moments. Everything looked great on the outside, but internally, he had been short-circuiting for some time. External appearances are not always a good indicator of what's going on inside. Secondly, don't overestimate your ability to pass tests based on your maturity and track record. Don't get overconfident in your ability to pass tests on your own. If it can happen to Judas, someone who is among the closest companions of the Son of God than it can happen to any nice, church-going, law-abiding citizen. It can happen to you. It has happened in every single age of the church. This writer named D.L. Bartlett writes this astonishing quote that anyone who thinks about Judas' situation, they always quote this, so I'm going to give it to you. He says, "Judas is a reminder that every day is judgment day, and that on any day some faithful follower, like Judas, or like you and me, might turn tail on the light and stumble out into the darkness, caught up in evil or caught up by evil's prince." So be on your guard. You may have a fantastic track record. You may have known about Jesus longer than you knew about your alphabet. Maybe you have led the church. Maybe you've brought many people to Jesus. You are not immune to the influence of darkness. Which is why all of us need to be praying people, right? Our Father, who art in heaven, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Number three, it's unlikely you will drive off a cliff without going through a few roadblocks first. I think that Roadrunner cartoons are probably banned from TV because they are so violent, but I grew up watching Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote and all those old cartoons. How many of you know what I'm talking about here? Just to make, okay, good. All the children who will never know who Roadrunner is are in Sunday school already. Oh, it's good. We're keeping away from such terrible influences. One of the classic things that always seems to happen to Wile E. Coyote is that he goes off cliffs, right, all the time. And often, it's like he goes through a few roadblocks and signs that say, danger, cliff ahead, right? Here's how Wile E. Coyote connects with the influence of darkness. It wasn't as though Judas woke up one morning totally in love with Jesus, and then the next day under the control of Satan. There was a whole bunch of roadblocks that he crashed through first, right? Which relates to the first point I make. We think that when the devil tempts us, it's going to be really obvious. There'll be a guy with pitchforks and horns and a cape, and we'll recognize him and we'll run the other way. He doesn't work like that. It's like Pinocchio's lies, which, you know, start out small, barely recognizable. They're barely lies. It's barely perceptible. But then the darkness leads us further and further away from the light until we can't find our way back. For example, in my experience, talking with men and women who have been a part of affairs or on the other side of affairs, it seems rare to me, from my experience, that people who are married fail the faithfulness test just because they happen to meet someone at a restaurant and then they're in the sack that night on a one-night stand. I'm sure it happens, but I don't run into it very often. Usually, it starts with fantasy, then it's emails and just talking, which develops into a lunch. And people say, well, what's wrong with some really heartfelt conversations? What's the matter with having lunch? It's just lunch. Can't I have friends of the other gender? Well, of course you can have friends with the other gender. You should have friends of both genders. But can't you see the way things are progressing right now that you are hitting roadblocks? In fact, you're crashing through them. But they disregard those comments from friends, and they're almost shocked and surprised that a few months later, emails and lunch have now matured into something else. Sex, lies, a wrecked family, ruined financial status. So if you don't want to drive off the cliff, pay attention to the roadblocks God will throw in front of you. And when you hit them, stop. turn around, walk back into the light while you still can. Let's turn the page from Judas for the last few minutes that we've got together and consider a little bit different kind of test. Because this is what happens in the room that night. Judas left, and with him gone, Jesus can finally relax. Now he can talk about the stuff that he really wants to talk about, which is really the rest of the sermon that we're going to look at together. Jesus begins prepping his guys for the trial that is about to come. He's getting them ready for this new season of life when he will no longer be with them. This is what happens, verse 33. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. And then, immediately after saying them, Jesus drops one of his most famous commands, verse 34. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Now you may wonder, I thought we were talking about tests. That's not a test, that's a command. Well, it is. It is a clear, unequivocal directive from Jesus for us to love fellow Christians. But it's also a test. According to Jesus, the test which indicates to the world around us whether or not we are really honestly connected with Jesus is this. Do we, that is Christians, the church, do we love each other? By this, he says, by this all people will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. The way people will know that we really follow Jesus is not by how much of the Bible we have memorized, not whether or not we have very strong boundaries on one particular doctrine, not by how much we give each month, or whether we stand against any particular sin in society, but by the way we love each other. Now, you may be wondering, just Christians? Like, we're just supposed to love each other and that's it? Well, not certainly. Our love should certainly extend beyond ourselves to other people who do not follow Jesus. The parable of the Good Samaritan illustrates that. But Jesus says here that it's our treatment of one another that will convince our friends and neighbors that we actually know him and are serious about following him. So, since we only have a little bit of time left, let's try to keep this immensely practical. If loving my fellow Christians is so important, how can I know that I'm loving well? Should we here institute a weekly hug quota? When you come to church, you know, 7 hugs, or else you're not following Jesus' command. Maybe we should be considering all 5 love languages: gifts, time, physical touch, verbal affirmation. Maybe it's just that we need to say the words more at church, right? I love you so much, man. Right? Should we do that? Some of you are like, oh yeah, and those non-touchers like me are like, oh man, I'm out. Those things could be a part of it. I'm not dismissing it. But I think the key to understanding what it means to love each other well is found in the little qualifier Jesus makes in verse 34. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. You know you are loving others well if your love looks like Jesus' love. So, what does his love look like? That's worth like 10 sermons, but let's look at a few ways here and we'll move quickly. Number one, I think Jesus' love is self-sacrificial. This goes back to the discussion we had last week on washing feet and servant leadership, but just look how this whole section starts. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave the world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love, which was foot washing, going to the cross. Jesus' love cost him something. It meant giving up liberties and privileges that were rightfully his. It meant putting the interests of others, our interests, above his own. Ultimately, loving led Jesus to the cross. And so, we need to ask ourselves, what does your love of other Christians cost you? Because I think it will exhaust you if you are really loving well. People will cross your boundaries. It will be painful. It will not be convenient. I want you all to get a picture of probably the most self-sacrificial person you know, your mother, okay? Think about her. Get her image in your mind. I know that some of you may have painful relationships with your moms, but for most of us, that's someone who's sacrificed quite a bit, right? Just think of how much raising you, loving you, cost your mom. Her body was never the same after she had you. She has more wrinkles because of you. She likely gave up some of her very best, most productive, straightforward-thinking, energetic years and dedicated that time instead to feeding you and wiping your butt. Best estimates today out on the cost of raising one kid from birth to 18 years is somewhere in the vicinity of $250,000. Yet your mom did it. Why? Because she loved you. She didn't just tell you. She didn't just give you hugs and then hope that you felt loved and then let you fend for yourself. She gave up part of her life so that you could live and thrive. You ready to love that way? In a way that costs you? Because that's how Jesus loved us. Another way that I think describes Jesus' love, and I had a tough time kind of putting it in a succinct way, and it's a little weird, but let's put it this way. Jesus' love was a family thing. It was a family thing. John actually reflected on this whole love topic quite a bit in his epistles. He writes some letters later on in his life. And this comes from him reflecting on Jesus' command here. This can be found in 1 John chapters 4 and 5. If anyone says, I love God, yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And he has given us this command, whoever loves God must also love his brother. Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. If I were to do a little poll here and ask, who loves God, I think there would be very few of you that would keep your hand down consciously, right? It's because most of the time when pastors ask you to do that, you're lazy. But if I were like, okay, you have to raise your hand if you love God, I know most of you would put up your hand. Of course we love God. We sing about that every week. And it's fairly easy to declare our love to God. But the thing is, through Jesus Christ, people get adopted into his Father's family. We become, through Jesus, God's kids, which is awesome, right? That's actually the theme of the women's retreat that's just concluding right now. They are daughters of the King. Isn't that fantastic? I am a child of God. He loves me and brought me into his family and gave me all the privileges that entails. Except that means, by extension, that you get a whole bunch of stepbrothers and stepsisters, right? Which is complicated. Think of your own family relationships right now. If you are an adult, because they are complex, aren't they? Probably your family is the source of some of your warmest, closest relationships, and perhaps the source of some of your deepest pain and hurt. Families are temperamental. Half temper, half mental. Someone has said that a dysfunctional family is any family with more than one person in it. Because all of us have weird aunts, right? All of our families have junk uncles that tell the same jokes over and over again. Cousins. We've got cousins who are idiots. We have in-laws, right? Mine are here today, so I can't talk to you truthfully about them. But they're family, right? So you commit to them. You stick up for them, right? I know if Cindy and I want to inject a little heat into the argument, she only needs to say something about how I'm so much like my father, to which I can respond some comment about her mother, and the temperature of the argument can go up quite a few degrees. But I extend my family a lot of grace, right? Because they're my family. Now, it sounds great in church. We love it to say that God's family is made up of people with different backgrounds, different opinions, different ages, different races, different musical tastes, different volume tastes, different economic background, until you actually are expected to hang out with those people and commit to them and stick up for them and not just like say hi to them in church, but actually live over a period of years and to do things together, then it's hard. Then it's not so idealistic. But these are brothers and sisters for whom Jesus died. And so we're called to love them just like Jesus. It's a family thing. Third, Jesus' love wasn't just a family thing. It wasn't just self-sacrificial. It was also proactive. Jesus took initiative. He reached out rather than waiting for the other person to move first. Listen to how John reflects on this again in 1 John. This is 1 John 4:10 and 19. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. We love because he first loved us. Jesus is assertive with his love, not passive. So why do we always ask people to do things in church, to take action? Why is it that we want to be friendly at church to new people? Why should we try to, like, uncomfortably try to find out who people are and introduce ourselves and go through those awkward initial conversations and have them in our homes when we have so many people that we already know and so many people that we already enjoy hanging out? Why should we serve in kids' ministry or youth ministry or any ministry for that matter? It's because Jesus' love is proactive. It seeks out, it is aware of people around. It includes, it takes initiative. It sees people who are excluded, hurting, vulnerable, maybe even hostile, and it seeks to bridge the gap with friendship, with healing, with, well, love. So, as you look at your love, the way you demonstrate care, affection, the way you notice people, the way you lean into needs around you, would you say that your love follows after the model of Jesus by being proactive, taking the initiative? That's by no means an exhaustive description of Jesus' love, but we're out of time. One last question. What if I can't? What if I just can't love that way? What if I can't pass this test? Am I just supposed to do it? Do it. Do it because we said it at church. Love because you have to, because it's the command of Jesus. Well, I have good news for you this morning. You don't need to force your love for other people. You just need to come back to the source. Here's what I mean. The last thing that happens in John chapter 13 is this little episode that many of you probably know about where Peter promises to stick with Jesus to the bitter end. I love you so much, he says, I will die for you, Jesus. And he makes a promise. But within 24 hours, he fails the love test miserably, right? He completely botches it, not once, not twice, but three times around a campfire. Peter swears that he doesn't even know Jesus. Epic fail. Epic fail. But if you read to the end of the book of John, you know that Jesus goes proactive on him, right? He brings Peter on a beach around a campfire and asks him three times, hey, Peter, do you love me? Yeah, Jesus, I love you. And Jesus totally forgives him. And from then on, campfires are never a reminder of failure for Peter. Because of what Jesus did on that beach, they become a reminder of Jesus' unconditional love and forgiveness. So as Peter went on to be a missionary, to lead the church, do you think he had a hard time loving, difficult to love people for the rest of his life? I'm sure there were hard times, but I would be willing to bet that this campfire encounter with Jesus changed him forever. If Jesus can love me, if Jesus would forgive me like that, then I can for sure love and forgive this sister for whom Jesus died. I've already experienced it. I'm happy to pass it on. If you are having a hard time passing the love test, then maybe you just need a fresh encounter with the living Jesus. We love not because he commanded us to do it, but because he loved us first. Would you stand as I pray for you this morning? Heavenly Father, it's my privilege to stand with these people this morning, your people, your family, actually. And our experiences of life right now are so diverse, I have no idea what stands ahead of those who are with me today. But we know that times of testing, if they're not already here, are probably only just ahead of us. And I ask for a fresh pouring of your Spirit on us so that we can pass the test that will be put in front of us. I pray that you would make us aware of the gravity of the decisions that we have every day. I pray that we would not overestimate our maturity and our ability to come out clean, but we would regularly cast ourselves at your mercy, that you would give us your grace and your strength to stand strong against the evil one who would be very happy for us all to be devoured. Would you protect us? Would you deliver us from evil? Would you fulfill your promise to not allow us to be tempted beyond what we are able to bear? And give us the humility to be able to come back into the light when we have already crashed through several boundaries. And I pray if today someone has done that, that they would sense your hand reaching out and extending and saying, hey, even now, we can turn this around. We can be friends. And I pray for the love capacity that we have for one another in this church family. Just like all church families, we're a huge mixture of people with all kinds of different experiences, different goals for our life, different ways that we relate to you. And we desperately need your help, Lord, to love each other as family. I pray first and foremost that you would give us, again, a fresh sense of your love. Help us to experience that, not just know about it and read about it, but to have a sense that we are loved and adopted and accepted by you. And out of that, would you give us the capacity to forgive, to sacrifice for the other, to understand, and to be proactive. I pray for the way that we treat one another, that we get involved in one another's lives, that we seek one another out. Would you grow that proactiveness within us? Thank you for being proactive, for sending Jesus for us. It's because of him that we're here. We pray this in his name.